The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Walker Wildman here with you on today's edition of the program. Glad to be with you today on the show. Let's turn our attention to the scripture. Proverbs chapter 14 is where we are this week. Verse 7, leave the presence of a fool, or you will not discern words of knowledge. Leave the presence of a fool, or you will not discern words of knowledge. And so surrounding yourself with a fool, especially consistently, will begin to wear off on you. That's what the scripture says here. To such a degree that eventually you will not be able to discern the truth. You will not be able to discern words of knowledge. And so that's Proverbs chapter 14, verse 7, with our wisdom of the day out of the book of Proverbs. Couple announcements. We still have our Ten Commandments speech challenge going on now. The cutoff is June 30th. So the end of the month is the cutoff. And this speech challenge is for those age 7 to 17. And what we're encouraging them to do here is about a 3 to 5 minute speech on the topic of the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. And so 3 to 5 minutes, you can have a parent or a sibling help you in writing, recording, and submitting the speech. So this is a team effort. Speeches must be submitted, as I mentioned, by the end of June. And everyone who participates will receive a Ten Commandments t-shirt, bookmark, and coupon code to use in the AFA Resource Center. For those asking, what do I do for 3 to 5 minutes? What kind of speech do I give regarding the first commandment? Well, this is where your creativity is going to have to kick in. And what we've seen in the past with previous challenges is that students, young people, use their creativity and they develop their own speech about why the first commandment is important. And so view it as if you are having to talk to a group of people who maybe aren't familiar with the Ten Commandments, aren't familiar with the First Commandment, and you're having to give up a 2, 3, 4 minute speech on why this is important for their lives and why God has this in the Ten Commandments. And so there's a little bit of a pointer for you as far as how to construct your speech. And then everybody will get a few things, as I mentioned, for participating. And so the important part is just participating. And these are very encouraging for us to receive these challenges. And Pastor Parker will play some of them on the air and he'll interview a couple of the participants. And so it's just a great challenge that we do each year. And we look forward to having those submissions. Couple other items. We're going to have our weekend with AFA coming up in October, and we have plenty of seats left if you want to go ahead and register on the dates are October 2 through 4, and that is the weekend with AFA. We're going to have Tim Barton here, Jenna Ellis, Jerry Boyer, and a couple others at our weekend with AFA in the first weekend of October. So we look forward to some of you who've already registered joining us. And if you haven't, go ahead and check that out and register. And we look forward to you visiting here in Tupelo, and we'll have a reception at our national headquarters for those who haven't visited our headquarters yet. And looking at some of the other speakers, I mentioned Tim, Jerry, Jenna, Abe will be with us. Abe Hamilton, JJ Jasper will be with us. And then our entire leadership team here at AFA will be with us as well. It kicks off on Thursday, that's the 2nd, and it concludes on Saturday afternoon, October 4th. So we look forward to seeing many of you in Tupelo with the Weekend with AFA coming October 2nd through the 4th here in Tupelo, Mississippi. AFA.net/events, AFA.net/events. One more housekeeping item, then we'll jump into some of the news of the day. The trips to Israel and Greece are open for registration now. That's in March of 2026. We're going to be going to Israel and Greece back-to-back. If you want to check those out, you can by simply visiting wildmangroup.com, wildmangroup.com. Check out our trips to Israel and Greece. The Greece trip is brand new. First time to Greece, footsteps of Paul. That's going to be in mid-March 2026. And we've already got, we're approaching one bus full already for that trip. And then our Boston trip in October of this year is already full. So you'll have to wait till 2026 to go with us to Boston and explore our Christian heritage there. All right, let's play a couple clips here. President Trump is weighing in on what's going on with Iran. And President Trump has been very consistent. I'll give him credit for this. He's been very consistent from a messaging standpoint on what his view is. And his view is simple, that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. And the reason we are at this point, at this juncture, is because Iran disagrees. Iran thinks they should have a nuclear weapon, and they think they should have one without any intervention from any other foreign country outside of Iran. So they think they should have a nuke. And President Trump says, no, I don't think you should. And that's the fundamental disagreement moving forward here. Here's President Trump when asked about, has your patience run out with Iran? He said, yeah, my patience ran out weeks ago. Let's listen.
President, what do you say to the Supreme Leader of Iran who says that they will not surrender?
Say good luck.
And what is the end game?
Run out with Iran? Say, when does your patience run out?
It's already run out. That's why we're doing what we're doing.
Take out
and 60 days and a big, you know, 60 days, plenty of time. And they made a mistake, honestly.
The U.S. does strike
their country's in ruins. So many people are dead that shouldn't be dead. Very sad thing.
Well, there President Trump says, look, my patience has already run out. That's why we are where we are. And you notice that President Trump keeps saying, this is why we're doing what we have to do. And he's talking about the Israeli and U.S. alliance. And so any news reporting that suggests that Netanyahu and his cabinet went forward with these strikes without full permission of President Trump is just straight up lying. There's no evidence of that. There is zero evidence to suggest that Israel went forward with the strikes a week ago without the consent and approval of President Trump. Zero evidence of that. And President Trump continues to talk in the we context. This is why we're doing what we're doing. And he hasn't said, well, Israel's doing what they got to do and we have nothing to do with it. He hasn't said that. And so it's clear that President Trump knew about and approved of the Israeli plan against Iran. And as it relates to what kind of intelligence that we had on Iranian nuclear development? Well, first off, I told you earlier in the week, and I think I covered this with Rick yesterday, Iran admitted that they've said publicly that they are working, that they want a nuclear weapon, they deserve a nuclear weapon, and they are working toward a nuclear weapon. All right? They have said all three of these things. They deserve to have a nuclear weapon, they want a nuclear weapon, and they are working currently to get a nuclear weapon. All right, so this isn't, these conspiracies by Tucker Carlson and others that suggest that, well, there's no evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapon. There's no evidence that Iran wants a nuclear weapon. There's no evidence that a nuke is even a problem in Iran, or that, you know, all these different questions about whether or not Iran wants a nuke and will get a nuke, all those things are based on no evidence. There's no substance behind those statements. They're intended to create doubt and chaos. And what I've learned over the years, especially in the last 6 months with President Trump in the White House, is that a lot of the conspiracy theories, a lot of the conspiracies that we were told to believe have actually turned out to have little or no evidence behind them, all right? And one example, and I'm getting a little bit off track here, but I do have a point. One example is we were told that the pipe bomber in D.C. on January 6th was that was an inside job, that the government did that, and the government knows who it was. I'm talking about the pipe bomb that was planted at the DNC, that the FBI knows who it is, and they're just refusing to arrest him because it was an inside job, and blah, 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 blah. With no evidence to support that, by the way. They just make these statements. This is the danger in believing everything you read on the internet, okay? And that there's a lot of the conspiracies and the theories end up being true. So I'm not totally discounting some of these theories, but we have to be careful. We have to be careful. And back to the pipe bomber, now you've got Dan Bongino and Kash Patel at the helm of the FBI, and they still haven't arrested the pipe bomber. They're actually have indicated that they're having trouble finding out who it was. And some people, well, that's hard. I don't know. I don't believe that. That's hard to believe. I think they know it. Well, you can say that all day long, but I'm just telling you, you think Dan Bongino and Kash Patel are lying to us? Like, if anybody has credibility in Washington, D.C., it's Dan Bongino and Kash Patel. All right? And so you can't accuse them of being sellouts now. So my point in all of this is that we have to be careful what theories we believe, and we have to make sure that people have some sort of evidence to support their theories. You can't just start throwing out this crazy stuff and expect everybody to bite on it. You have to have something to go along and support your theories instead of just pulling the whole trust me mindset. And so, once again, I had a point here. A lot of the people that are against engaging with Iran, war with Iran, they don't want us to support Israel. They say that, well, Iran doesn't have nukes, and they'll never have nukes, and nukes aren't even a problem. Israel's just making all this up. Well, okay. Number one, you don't have anything to prove that. You're just literally pulling stuff out of your pocket. But furthermore, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, went on national television today and let us know that, well, Iran actually does have nukes, and here's how many nukes they have. Clip four.
When you say 60, that's misleading when people hear that number, because they think 60% enrichment, 90% is what you need for a weapon. Actually, 90% of the work it takes to get to weapons-grade enrichment is getting to 60. Once you're at 60, you're 90% of the way there. You are, in essence, a threshold nuclear weapon state, which is what Iran basically has become. They are at the threshold of a nuclear weapon. If they decided to do so, they can do so very quickly. If they stockpile enough of that 60% enriched, they could very quickly turn it into 90 and weaponize it. That's the danger we face right now. That's the urgency here. That's why Israel feels urgency about it. And that's why we feel urgency about it. But not just us. Throughout the Gulf region, no country in the region wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon. And you also talk about not just a weapon. They have long-range missiles that they can deliver those weapons to. This is a very grave risk. And they are enriching at that level, and they're openly doing it, by the way. In fact, their Congress, their legislative branch, actually passed a law requiring them to enrich at a certain level because JCPOA, the Obama deal with Iran, was canceled. So this is a critical moment. The president has made it a priority, and now people understand the urgency here because they are fairly close, too close for comfort to a nuclear weapon. We have to roll that back one way or another, and we hope it's peacefully and through the process of negotiation.
You know, I think this response by Iran to Israeli striking some of their military assets, I think it further bolsters the argument that Iran is an out-of-control state. They're not a rational actor. They will pursue nukes. They will use them if they can against Israel and their enemies. And here's why. Iran has yet to come to the table. They said today, no, we're not coming to the table. They said, we're in it till the end. Really? You're in it till the end. You are getting obliterated. You are getting obliterated you're on the precipice of the entire government falling. Trump tells the Ayatollah, we know where you are, we know where you sleep. And the Iranian response is, we're in it till the end? Really? Okay. Let's see how this goes, because it's not going very good. This shows you how irrational the Islamic radicals are that are at the helm of government in Iran.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you with us on this edition of The Core. As a reminder, we do upload the show in the form of a podcast each and every afternoon. You can just simply go to your podcast store, your podcast library, type in the name of the show, At the Core, and click the subscribe button. Or if you're on Apple, I've learned recently it's a follow button, which was news to me. I've always been using the word subscribe, but you can follow on Apple. And you can subscribe on the other platforms as well to the podcast, and we'll queue it up in your library each and every day for your convenience and for you to listen and catch past interviews, maybe some that you missed there on the podcast. All right, let's jump to our next guest. Reggie Littlejohn is with us. Reggie's been with us before, and she is founder and president of the Anti-Globalist International Organization, and she's here to talk about this World Health Organization pandemic treaty that has been a threat for nearly a year or more now before the WHO. This goes back to Biden's era as president. Reggie, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Reggie, we've had you on before to talk about this, and it's obviously still a very important topic because it's still before the World Health Organization, and they're continually trying to push this. But bring us up to speed for those who aren't familiar with this topic. Bring them up to speed on what exactly this pandemic treaty is that the World Health Organization continues to push.
Okay. So first thing I want to say is I was listening to your last segment and you said, you know, don't believe in conspiracy theories. You got to, you know, check out the documents yourself. If anybody thinks that this is a conspiracy theory, I just want you to know I'm an attorney. I have analyzed these documents, and if you want to see all the hyperlinks in the footnotes, go to antiglobalist.net and look at on the resources page, and you will have all the hyperlinks, all the footnotes. Everything I'm telling you is true, okay? So where we are right now is a year ago May, the World Health Organization at its World Health Assembly passed the International Health Regulation Amendments, and then this May, on May 20th, they passed the pandemic treaty. And to get these two documents are meant to be read together. And together, what they do is they basically set up the precursor to a biotech surveillance police state. And as the readers may know, or the listeners may know, Trump withdrew us from the World Health Organization on his first day in office. That withdrawal will not take effect until 1 year later, January of 2026. But that does not stop the World Health Organization's policies from having terrible effects in the United States, even if we aren't members. So I want to go over a couple of these things. In the pandemic treaty, they passed something called the Pathogen Access and Benefit Sharing System, which is it's a system by which countries, like mostly developing countries, are encouraged to go out into their jungle or their rainforest or whatever, discover deadly pathogens instead of just leaving them there in the jungle, okay, or quarantining them. They discover deadly pathogens. That's a pathogen with pandemic potential. And then they send them to the World Health Organization, which will then send them to labs all over the world, ostensibly so that these labs can create vaccines and other therapeutics. So what this system will do is it will concentrate all the world's most deadly pathogens into the hands of an unelected, unaccountable bureaucratic organization under the influence of the Chinese Communist Party and the pharmaceutical industry. And to the extent that COVID-19 was a lab leak, this greatly expands the chances of lab leaks, you know, sending these deadly pathogens to labs all over the world, which will in turn greatly enrich Big Pharma. And will also give countries that are so inclined the pretext under which to deprive citizens of their constitutional rights through lockdowns, vaccine mandates, mask mandates, et cetera. So that's just one of many problems that is in the pandemic treaty.
Let me ask you this, Reggie. The withdrawal from the WHO that President Trump initiated, and obviously everybody cheered him on because it's a good move because of how just terrible the WHO has become. And this, what you're talking about is really Exhibit A. But does this, I'm comparing it almost to the UN, and I know these are two different agencies, two different institutions. Does us withdrawing from WHO actually make it worse off in that they're just like rogue and there's no check that the U.S. can provide? Or would they have been able to pass something like this even if we objected and abstained or voted no? I mean, what are we losing out, I guess, on having a say if we're not a member?
Well, that's the argument that people have been weighing back and forth. And I understand that argument. And I think that it would have been great in some ways if, I mean, we still are members. We're not out until January 2026. And President Trump decided to make it a clean break. We're not paying them anything. We're not attending their meetings. We're not voting on their stuff. But I would have loved to have seen, you know, the United States get up during one of these meetings at the World Health Assembly and say, well, we object to this, and these are the reasons why. And, you know, not only are we not voting for this, but we're leaving the World Health Organization, because there's a lot of countries that I believe would stand up together with us if we would provide, you know, more support. But to that extent, listen, you know, Secretary of HHS Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has announced that what he wants to do is the United States and Argentina have both withdrawn, and together they are wanting to launch an international consortium of free countries that will provide, deal with health, global healthcare crises and issues, and not be the corrupt WHO. And so I guess instead of trying to salvage the WHO in some way, what the sense is of the administration is to start over again with something new that we would be at the helm of. And I agree with that. I think that's a great strategy.
I do want to get back into the future of this treaty, because obviously, as you mentioned, coming into the program when you and I were talking, this is really just getting started. This is a multi-year process by the WHO. But is this, and I have, there's the biblical response, and then there's kind of the pragmatic response or practical response, even setting aside how God set up governments and nations to be independent. But do you think that these global organizations are even a good idea? Because biblically it doesn't seem like a good idea, because God developed nations and borders for them to operate independently. That doesn't mean you can't have alliances and partnerships, but it seems as though anytime these globalist entities get set up, maybe they get set up for good purposes, they just seem to always go off track.
Well, they absolutely go off track. And yeah, like the World Health Organization, you can argue it was set up for a good purpose. I mean, so in the beginning, they were very humble and they just wanted to deal with sanitation and polio, but then now they've gone off track. But I want to say something, Walker, which is this: there is a gentleman named Dr. Brock Chisholm. He was the first director general of the World Health Organization, the first one. And he once stated, quote, "To achieve world government, it is necessary to remove from the minds of men their individualism, loyalty to family traditions, national patriotism, and religious dogmas."
Hmm.
I mean,
that answers my question.
Yeah, you can't get more globalist than that.
Yeah.
And also, just as an aside, he was a psychiatrist. So I shudder to think how he would effectuate removing from the minds of men,
right,
you know, our individuality, our loyalty to our family, our nations, and our religions. And so he was the first director general of the World Health Organization. So I would submit to you that perhaps the impetus behind it from the beginning was global control.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. And when you look at it from that vantage point with that information, then this thing was never really on track, truly. Maybe they did some virtuous things to begin with. But this whole notion, Reggie, of exercising control over nations and countries around the world is very, number one, it's, and as an attorney, you know this, when you at, when you pass a resolution or a, whatever you want to call this, a treaty, the question is, how is it enforced? Is it binding and how is it enforced? And God did not intend for to have some one world government. I mean, every nation has its own kings, has its own rulers, has its own authorities. And we were never intended to operate under some globalist structure. So it just doesn't, the whole notion behind it just doesn't work, because any country can just be like, hey, we're not doing that. And there's nothing that these national entities, these international entities can do about it unless they want to go to war about it, maybe.
Well, okay, so there's a lot of nuance to that question. I guess what you could say is, for a powerful country like the United States, if we have the right administration in place, like the Trump administration that says, look, just go fly a kite, we're not going to have anything more to do with you, there's not a whole lot they can do about it. But, you know, that's one of the reasons that that election mattered so much, because if Kamala Harris had been elected, she would just be enforcing all this stuff, because it was under the Biden-Harris administration that a lot of the infrastructure of this, the framework of all these terrible things were put forward in writing. It was really the United States that played a major role in the impetus for all of this. But the way I look at this is like, this is like a construction of the Tower of Babel. And in particular, the digital ID aspect of this.
Yeah.
So in the international health regulations, and also in to a lesser extent in the pandemic treaty, it talks about digital. We talk about everybody in the world needs to have a health ID. These health IDs need to be international. They need to be interoperable. And in fact, the Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus announced the launch of the World Health Organization European Union Global Health Certification Network on June 5th, 2023, which is an international interoperable so-called health ID. But that health ID establishes the technical platform for the more robust digital ID that you can find on the World Economic Forum website. There's a chart of the digital ID, and what they want this for is that everyone in the world is going to have a digital ID in order to access healthcare, open a bank account, buy and sell online. This is very related to the Book of Revelation. Travel, access social media, file taxes, vote, collect government benefits, own a telecommunications device like a cell phone or a laptop, and participate in social media. So basically, what these digital IDs are ultimately, I believe, going to be do is to connect everyone to AI and establish a China-style social credit system worldwide, and that is totally against free will, which is one of the main characteristics with which God created us.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And we're going to talk more about this in the next segment and actually break down the next steps on this treaty, you know, the process, the multi-year process, and what the U.S. and others can do to continue to fight back against this pandemic treaty that was brought about by the World Health Organization. But to your point, I think there's two things driving these bad actors here. And when I say bad actors, I'm talking about those at the World Health Organization and otherwise that thought this was a good idea. It's clear that there's two factors driving them, and this is just looking at it from a very high-level vantage point. It's money and control. Those two things are indisputable. Now, you could get into, you know, do they have evil intentions and things like that, and you could debate that and look at, you know, who's behind it and things like that. But what we know for certain is that money and control together are behind a lot of this. Because to your point, a lot of these multinational corporations, these globalist mindset leaders in the world, they think there's a ton of money to be made in controlling the population, and then syncing up all of our systems, right? All the technology, integrating all of it around the world so that citizens can, you know, go all over the place and commerce, et cetera, et cetera. But the AI, the digital ID and the AI, I want folks to understand that this is not some, you know, 50 years down the road, sci-fi type reality. This stuff's right around the corner. With AI developing as fast as it is, and this constant need to be able to move across systems and platforms without having to set up new profiles and new accounts. I mean, this digital ID, I believe, is going to become the topic of conversation if it's not already, Reggie.
I absolutely agree with that. And with AI being, the infrastructure being created so quickly, you know, with Stargate and the $500 billion that is half $1 trillion that's going to be farmed out to just creating data centers all over the country. Mm-hmm. That's what we need to be running AI, and we're running a risk that in trying to beat China, we're going to become China.
Yeah, that's scary, Reggie. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about this in the next segment because I think all of this dovetails in together. I think that the pandemic treaty, the digital ID, wanting to get so-called health information in a international globalist format to where everybody can read it and understand it. I think this all plays in well together. And there's a provision in this piece of legislation that President Trump's trying to get to the finish line, the One Big Beautiful Bill. There's actually a provision on AI that actually bars states from legislating on or regulating artificial intelligence for the next 10 years. It puts up basically a moratorium on AI regulations from a state level on AI. And the excuse is, well, we don't want to, you know, impede on innovation. But the consequence is, well, it's the Wild Wild West. Around the country on AI, unless Congress gets involved. Reggie Littlejohn is with us, and Reggie is the president and founder of the multiple organizations, but the one we're talking about today is Anti-Globalist International, and we're talking about the World Health Organization Pandemic Treaty that's already kind of passed its first iteration at the WHO. So we'll be back in just a few minutes and Reggie will rejoin the show.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the Core here on American Family Radio. We have on the line with us Reggie Littlejohn. Reggie is founder and president of the Anti-Globalist International. We've been talking about the World Health Organization Pandemic Treaty that they are continuing to push and pass through the World Health Organization. And then we've also talked a little bit about how that fits into the AI, artificial intelligence development domestically and some of the concerns there. Regarding human rights, honestly, and privacy and constitutional rights as well. Reggie, welcome back. Let's break down, before we continue talking AI, which is a very interesting topic with the provision in the legislation and the reconciliation bill, give us the status of where this pandemic treaty is within the process at the World Health Organization.
The World Health Organization approved it, but with a reservation, which is, or I don't know if the reservation, but there's an annex that is going to give the it's going to give the details of the pathogen access and benefit sharing system. So that's the guts of the whole thing, and they haven't even spelled it out yet. That's going to be they haven't even drafted that yet. That's probably going to be voted on in May of 2026, and then after that, it's going to go through the ratification process of the various countries, and then once 60 countries have ratified it, then it will enter into force, I believe, 30 days after that. So there's two ways that this could be stopped. Number one, if the annex is stopped, and so, you know, once they publish it, I'm sure that we will be able to see all kinds of problems with the pathogen access and benefit sharing system. And then the other way is to have an international campaign for countries not to approve the pandemic treaty. But I want to say something, one more thing. about logistics, which is President Trump, he withdrew us from the World Health Organization, but the next, by executive order, the next president, if he or she is so inclined, could put us right back in. So we need legislation in addition to the executive order. And if people want to take action on that, on my website, antiglobalist.net, antiglobalist.net, you can just go up to the upper right-hand side and it says take action. There's a red button. Click that, and then you can take action by clicking on the icon that says support legislation to withdraw the U.S. permanently from the World Health Organization.
Let me ask you this, and then we'll move on to AI. But obviously, you know, what you've outlined here with this pandemic treaty is a nightmare. And should mm-hmm. we have another pandemic, which I don't know why. I don't know why Fauci and these others keep talking, and Bill Gates, like they know something that we don't about another pandemic. I mean, they keep talking so confidently that we will have another pandemic. And I'm asking them, I'm wanting to ask them, like, what do you know? Are y'all, you know, do y'all have another leak in Wuhan that we need to know about? But the number of countries that need to ratify this, in order for it to become legally binding, and I know you mentioned the kind of this 2 to 3 year approach and these multiple phases of passing with the initial phase already complete, is there enough support within the World Health Organization as it stands today to ratify this, or do they still need to pick up more countries to vote on this?
Oh, I think there's enough support today to ratify it. I think that most countries in the World Health Organization, first of all, I don't even know that the delegates that go to the World Health Organization are there's a problem there with them becoming more loyal to the World Health Organization than they are to their original countries. There's kind of a tension there, okay? Mm-hmm. But then beyond that, China has outsized influence at the World Health Organization and at the United Nations because of so many countries are indebted to them, you know? Through this thing called the Belt and Road Initiative, where they give countries loans in order to create infrastructure. But if they can't pay back the loan, which a lot of these poorer countries cannot pay back the loan, then China can take over the infrastructure. And so there's a lot of countries that just they do what China wants because China's got them, you know, held over a bucket. There's nothing else that they can do. So I think that if there were a vote today, that it probably would pass.
Mm. The AI that is obviously, I've been actually kind of studying up and reading and watching and listening to different content on the development of AI. And I've got to admit, once again, we're talking to Reggie Littlejohn with the Anti-Globalist International Organization. I've got to admit, Reggie, the AI, I've obviously experienced a lot of technology throughout my life with the cell phone and the internet and the computer, and now you've got the iPhone. AI is pretty intimidating. I'm not going to say scary, but what they're planning on AI doing is very, very concerning. What are your thoughts on it?
AI could be used for very great good, and it could also, in the wrong hands, be used for very great evil. So, for example, when the Trump administration announced Stargate at 10 a.m. on Trump's first full day in office, Trump invited Larry Ellison, the head of Oracle, to cast his vision about why we need $500 billion, in other words, $500 billion, in AI data center infrastructure in the United States. And what Mr. Ellison said is, we can use this to create individualized mRNA vaccines for people's personal cancer tumors. That's what he said publicly. Okay. What he said to Oracle in a talk that he gave to Oracle in September or October of 2024, so pretty recently, mm-hmm. is that he felt that AI was really important because in his vision of the future, everyone would be wearing a body cam. There would be a dash cam for every car, ring cameras on, you know, everybody's house, surveillance cameras on all the corners. And this would be a good thing because it would keep the police on their best behavior because they know that everything is being uploaded into AI in real time. And it would also keep citizens on their best behavior because they would know that everything is being uploaded into AI at every moment. Everything you say, everything you do, you know, your view of the world through the camera on the AI. And that if there's a problem, that they could deploy drones. And he gave an example of a shooting at a shopping center, and he said, you know, that never would have happened if we had AI because we would have deployed drones and you know, immediately, and they can get there faster than police can. So that's what he was talking about for AI.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is the most dystopian thing I can imagine.
Yeah. And my main concern, well, there's a lot of concerns, but if I had to prioritize them, this whole replacement of the human, to me,
yes. Is,
and we could get into, like, you know, how many jobs is it going to take and stuff, and a lot of people are approaching this from employment standpoint and an economic standpoint, and I get it, but my main concern is a moral concern of displacing the human. So we're basically, mm-hmm. AI is basically compiling vast amounts of human intelligence because there is mm-hmm. no intelligence and knowledge outside of God, and God created man in his image. So we are bearers of knowledge that no other creature is able to, an intelligence that no other creature is able to replicate and do like the human can. And we're compiling all this human knowledge into a computer database, a massive storage of computer database, and basically replicating vast amounts of human knowledge and turning it into robots, which displaces, to me, and in many regards, displaces the human factor, which that's like, I can't even fathom where that leads humanity down when we displace ourselves.
Well, and not only are we displacing ourselves, and then there's the whole transhumanism debate of, you know, people getting Neuralink and whatever else in, you know, in their bodies so that there is a connection between your body and the internet. But also AI in some ways is displacing government. I mean, there is a movement called the technocracy movement that believes that democracies are really passe and that elected officials really shouldn't be running the world. Who should be running the world is the technocrats, who will decide, you know, who will follow the science or create the science or whatever, and then create society in accordance with their so-called science. So that it's a way of replacing the state government, okay, and then also ultimately replacing God. It's like you look to AI for your answers. You don't look to God. You don't pray for an answer to a question you had. You look it up on ChatGPT or whatever. And that the one who is perceived to be running the world is not, you know, God and the, you know, Lordship of Jesus Christ, but it's AI. So, I mean, like I said before, I think that this is a Tower of Babel situation, and we really need God to intervene in this situation.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I don't think there's stopping AI. I think that's fairy tale land to think that we can stop AI because it has the potential to do evil. It has the potential to do a lot of good, to your point, just like all technologies and innovations in the past. But this is a little different. This is different than your traditional, you know, industrial revolution type development. It's a whole another level. And I think the moral discussion, I think Christians need to speak more verbally and vocally into this AI topic and bring a biblical mindset to it. And I think it's going to be important for Christians and ministries to develop their own AI models that bear truth, that we use the Word of God to develop AI, and we train the knowledge based off of God's Word. I think that's gonna be important for Christians to do as well, because to your point about people going to AI for the truth, we've got to assume that AI is providing truth. And if there are pagans and unbelievers pumping lies and falsehoods into the AI model, then that's what's going to get pumped out, and people are going to be led astray. Hey, Reggie, tell our folks where they can find out more about your work and track all that you're doing regarding the World Health Organization and other topics as well.
Please go to antiglobalist.net. That's just one word, antiglobalist.net, and sign the manifesto on the first page. It's on the home page. That will put you in touch with me. That will put you on my newsletter, my email newsletter list, and then I can show you different places that you can take action, because we are up on all of these issues, and there are things that you can do to help that are not time-consuming, but ways of reaching your congressional representatives that will help for example, to regulate AI. We're going to be putting something up about that shortly.
All right. Thanks so much, Reggie. Appreciate you coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. That's Reggie Littlejohn, founder and president of Anti-Globalist International, and we'll link to her website, antiglobalist.net, on the show notes and all the information you need to know there. I do want to play a clip that really complements our discussion today, and this is the Energy Secretary talking about the development of nuclear modular power and how that's going to be necessary for AI development. He doesn't mention AI, but there's no doubt this is why this is being deployed here. Let's listen to clip five.
Congress has made key investments in nuclear innovation, and you're an expert in the area. These investments include the Nuclear Fuel Security Act to strengthen our fuel supply chain and the Advanced Reactor Demonstration Program to move advanced reactors forward. Can you speak about those plans in the program?
Yeah, there's lots. And in fact, I have a new one today. Maybe we will announce today a new solicitation that we would like to get three new small modular reactors critical, meaning producing power by July 4 of next year at the Idaho National Lab in our containment facility that can sort of speed up ideas that are ready to go. Let's get them on the ground and test them and prove them. Because look, the Americans invented the nuclear power industry. We came out and built 100-plus plants rapidly. Then we created an NRC and stopped. And we haven't done much for 30 or 40 years. You and I and many others really want to get that nuclear ball rolling again.
The idea here is the modular nuclear power is basically taking nuclear power and enabling it for a campus, for a facility, for a manufacturing facility, for a data center. Instead of having a massive nuclear power facility miles away, hundreds of miles away, that then has transmission lines all throughout the state and then delivering power to various communities, this will be basically a mini nuclear power modular type setup that is able to be deployed on a probably a broad scale. Now there's going to have to be all kinds of regulations to ensure safety and efficiency, but my view of this is we don't see rapid AI development without deploying modular nuclear power. I just don't think, and this isn't an anti-fossil fuel talking point, I just don't think we can scale our traditional fuel supplies, fuel sources, i.e. natural gas, coal, etc. I don't think we can scale them at a pace that can keep up with AI data center development. I just don't think we can, because what we're doing now with AI data centers is we're talking about rapid deployment, rapid construction over the next 3 to 5 years that our traditional power co-ops are just not going to be able to keep up with. That's a fact. And that's why the Trump administration is leaning into modular nuclear power. And I think it's a good idea as long as we ensure safety. We'll see you next time. As we celebrate the many pro-life victories going forth, we rejoice. Preborn's network of clinics has a unique opportunity to advance even further without political persecution. What does this look like? Preborn is the greatest threat to the abortion industry. By rescuing, on average, 200 babies' lives a day, they are putting a serious dent into the abortion holocaust. But there are still thousands of babies who are slain daily, and Preborn's goal is to rescue them all. With the help of the pro-life community, meaning you, we can save so many more. Please join us in saving all these precious lives. The ultrasound is a game changer. Once a mother hears the precious heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. If you consider yourself pro-life, we need your help. One ultrasound is just $28. Five ultrasounds are $140. $5,000 sponsors ultrasounds for the entire preborn network for an entire day. How many lives can you save? Every child is a beautiful gift from God. Please join the calls. To donate securely, please dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250, say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.